moves from a textbook example of impressionism toward a textbook example of expressionism in one poem.
What ism would you nail on the end?
Poem ism, or something like this. No ism, ridiculism.
Yeah.
Okay, I heard it once on a radio, read by the author. And it's a very strange way of reading. I can try to imitate this. Mm. In other words, you stay at one level with your voice.
Yeah.
You never go up or down or something like this. You just, pardon? You can either pronounce it in Ceylan or Ceylon, either German or French. Sometimes you live in Germany, sometimes in France. Well, we can discuss this a little bit at 4 o'clock this afternoon if you want. It's an interesting poem and a completely new technique. Unfortunately, the only successful one. I think so. The others are a little strange.
You have to discuss Whitehead at 4.
Pardon?
I have to discuss Whitehead at 4.
Uh-huh.
Too many things going on at the same time.
Right. That's always the problem. But I think a certain variety is good.
Yeah.
Well, last time we talked about attempts to classify 20th century literature, terms like modern, 20th century, contemporary, they all didn't quite work out. And then I mentioned another attempt, namely classification according to the beloved isms, you know, like impressionism, expressionism, symbolism, dadaism, surrealism, futurism, and so on and so on and so on. This also didn't quite work out because they were too specific and you really couldn't form certain groups that actually would be distinct from each other. Another attempt was, as we saw, a classification according to political history, which is done very frequently. You just say poetry before or after the French Revolution and so on. This also is not quite satisfactory because usually the poets stand apart from the time. You know. And the best example is the so-called German Expressionism, with a rather gloomy or shocking kind of poetry at a time when Germany was rich, wealthy, self-assured. So it actually contradicts the time here. Now, may I just report a few other attempts of classifying this funny phenomena which we call 20th century or modern or just recent poetry or good poetry. There's one phenomenon which is mentioned very frequently, namely the so-called poet critic. Have you heard this name before? In other words, that you do not have poets that are roaming the countryside, wandering lonely as a cloud. You know, isn't that Wordsworth? apart from everything, but usually and to an increasing degree, you find poets commenting on their own poetry in radio stations, in public discussions, in sessions, and there are many, many of them. So it's not only that they more or less pretend that the spirit moved them, and that they are just the voice of a higher power, so to speak, that makes them say these lines, but that they are very much aware of the fact that they're actually working at it. They're very much conscious how much work goes into it. This is not saying that there is no inspiration, but inspiration is usually the first step. And then a very hard labor, so to speak, starts.
Is that an attempt to justify maybe their existence to a public that does not think of them as prophets
No, I wouldn't say so. Only the majority of these modern authors think that they are much better critics than other critics, than newspaper critics.
Yeah.
And you have this problem right now, I think, when you just look at the fact which poems are selected. You know, who does the selecting? Who says this is good, it should be printed, and who says this is bad? You really don't know. There are some editors and some huge skyscrapers in New York, and all of a sudden this is being published. There is a good movement, I think, that sort of counteracts this predominance of the critics and the editors, namely the underground poetry, which you have probably seen. Very cheap paper, cheap material, you know, and they are gaining, especially San Francisco or New York. I think San Francisco is about the greatest right now.
Taking the little magazines or the big little magazines.
Right.
Like the 60s. Are you acquainted with that one? The 60s?
The magazine called the 60s? No, not really. Well, I've heard of it, but I don't know.
Puts it out. It's published in Ireland. Get it cheap and then got it back here.
Yeah.
And he won the National Book Award for poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Year before, like the same year Holly won Palm Award for the Scary Birds.
I see.
But,
now, Ireland has a certain tradition of being very modern, open to new things. They have a basic reason. This is just a legalistic reason, in that they don't have laws that would censor books in such a degree as America or England would. So many books actually that cannot be published in England or the United States are published in Ireland, because, for instance, they have no laws against four-letter words. The best example is Joyce's Ulysses, you know, that couldn't be printed in England because it had lots of dirty words in it. It couldn't be printed in America before there's a long court decision. Have you ever seen a copy of Joyce's Ulysses? You have about two pages in front the judgment of some judge saying, well, this was literature and therefore should be measured from a different point of view as other things. In other words, the dirty words were part of the work and not an aim in itself, and therefore it could be published. And then signed judge so-and-so, and then finally it could be published by a random house. But Ireland could do that earlier, finally. But in England it still can't be printed. They either have the Irish edition or the American edition, but there's no English edition after this very day. You cannot do this. And so Ireland sort of has this tradition of printing.
Also, it's cheap too.
Right.
Very.
Yeah, this is a labor problem in Ireland, because they have always been overpopulated, you know, there isn't enough labor, although some industry is moving in, but it is moving in because labor is so cheap in Ireland.
Yeah.
Okay, back to this point of the so-called poet-critic. Also, another point is that most of these poets nowadays are not lonely wanderers, as we said, but they're university professors. They work in publishing houses. T.S. Eliot even owned a vast amount of a publishing house, Faber in London. You know. Or they write for newspapers. In the United States, they're usually university professors. So they are much more, I would say, much more learned, much more academic than poets before. And this changed it also. Secondly, we might add here, there always has been a traditional revolt against previous art forms and literary theories. But now there is one under, a more general and, as I would say, a more convincing idea. Namely, they do not differentiate so much between previous, let's say, 19th century art and 20th century art, but they try to differentiate just between art and non-art. This was first started in Italy, a movement by Benedetto Croce, C-R-O-C-E, a famous critic who wrote a book, Poesia e non poesia, so art and non-art, actually. And this spread almost everywhere. So this idea is not to say 19th century was wrong, because we have new ideas, we have a different social condition right now, we have different political systems, but just to say, well, this is genuine art under these principles and this is not. So frequently works were discovered which you didn't find in textbooks before. All of a sudden nowadays they're considered great art, and vice versa. You have things that were acclaimed very much, you know, like The Charge of the Light Brigade. Have you ever heard of this funny thing, you know? I already said funny thing, but all the little English kids had to learn this by heart. It was the greatest poem, or one of the great poems. Nowadays, ask a little English schoolboy, wouldn't even know it. See, and I think this is good. It's something that's connected with history, but it's not necessarily good art. So this is a very good and also a rather drastic change when you criticize from this. Now, if you follow the idea, you see again that the modern poet in a certain way stands apart, but in a different way. He stands apart because he is convinced that his creation of art is sort of a philosophy of life. This process of creating art becomes his only means of, let's say, to stand the impact of 20th century life. He has to create in order to live. It is not something he does beside his work, but this is his only method or his only possibility of being able to live in this 20th century. So in this way, he does stand apart because he is frequently dissatisfied with his social or intellectual surroundings, whether they are religious or philosophical or nationalistic. So strictly speaking, we could say that there is no Christian poet or a Czechoslovakian novelist or something like that. But nowadays there is only a poet, a playwright, a novelist. He's either good or bad, but he is not Christian or Russian or Turkish or whatever it is. On top of being a good poet, so to speak, they may also be Czechoslovakian or American or German. See, but the first thing is they have to be genuine, great poets. Now, also, this we might add as number four, in the 19th century, rather late in the 19th century, the term world literature was created. In other words, a literature which was directed against strictly national literatures. And now, and this actually, I think, has come true in our 20th century. The authors, to a much greater degree than ever before, are aware of foreign literatures, maybe supported by mass media, whatever is being published in New York is in Paris about 3 days later, and vice versa. What they publish in Prague is immediately performed on the stages in Germany nowadays. A little too much right now. Czechoslovakian poetry and plays are just the thing. There's no other author. But still, the media really help, and so this is not only true for contemporary literature, but from there also for literature of the past. Also, there has been a greater understanding of really foreign literatures, especially Indian literatures and primitive literatures, folk poetry, which nobody actually looked at. Then, usually via mainly, I would say, Ezra Pound and his school, Chinese and Japanese poetry. I mean, just ask your parents whether they heard of Chinese poetry. Probably they heard of it, there was a little bit. But nowadays, especially through Pound, we are aware of this. People are imitating this. Even in the Koinonia Library, we have anthologies of haikus, the Japanese poem. What does that mean? You can't stand them anymore, or too much? Pardon?
They're too much.
Yes, okay, but still, as I say, the awareness of other poetry is not only within the Western culture, but it also moves into the Eastern culture.
Well, the images, and then, what was it? Ezra Pound or something.
Right, right.
And some of the others, that was really the first
in the United States,
yes. States, with the images, and that was around 1906.
Mm-hmm. Right. In Germany, you have a similar movement, and in England and France, too. All of a sudden, this was discovered. Mm-hmm. You know, not as something strange that is strictly connected with Japanese or Chinese culture, but something that would give a good deal to our Western poetry. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is new. And from there, strangely enough, it also spread, let's say, to classical antiquity. All of a sudden, people start reading Horace again and Virgil. Before, it was maybe a required subject, you know. You had to, when you want to go into the ministry, you better take some Latin, you know. And then you had to plow through Horace, you know, depending on the professor. All of a sudden, you get more and more, and you there's a new understanding of this kind of this poetry. So, from this point of view, you might say that the modern poet is not isolated, he is not without tradition, but also he creates his own tradition from this new understanding of the history of poetry and of literature. Also, we may add to this, there is a second aspect, namely there's an unprecedented understanding among contemporary writers. This does not mean that they are all uniform, that they are all writing about the same themes or using the same techniques. No, But there is an appreciation of their art, which is greater than ever before. Maybe when you consider American poetry, Russian poetry, we know quite sure that, for instance, poetry written under the Stalin era in Russia, nobody would ever read that. Have you ever heard of it? This kind of poetry, strictly communistic poetry or art, films, plays, whatever it is, sculpture. Yeah, it's never been printed. This is a good example, or it's never been shown in books. Because even here, we realize immediately this is no art. It is plain trash. It's just nonsense. So we evaluate immediately, saying that this is, well, a good example to show how communism is great and blah, 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 all this. But on the other hand, you have a poet like Yevtushenko, and nobody in the United States thinks, well, oh, he's a communist. Nobody does it. We say it's excellent poetry this man writes. Or some people say Pasternak wrote an excellent novel. I don't, but some people do. So we are not thinking of communist ideas. We are just thinking of this as a great novel. This is excellent poetry. Whereas the other one, the communist trash, it's never been published yet, although it would be quite interesting. You should see a film or something like this. It's really, it's gorgeous. It's outstanding. Love stories. There's the young worker so-and-so and the young maiden so-and-so. You know, they all go to... they work 6 days a week, and then on Sunday they attend the party festivals and things like that, and have a nice dance and the hammer and sickle. And then they have only one wish: the community needs a new tractor. Okay, and then they work overtime voluntarily. You know. And each time in the evening the sun sets red, of course, you know, and you see, and they have the vision of the bright new shiny tractor standing there. With all this overtime work, you know, at the end, finally they make it, they can buy this tractor. You know, and then, of course, they also fall in love, but only because they work on the to get the tractor, you know, and then the sun sets red again. So. Yeah. It's quite amazing because it's so similar in all countries where you have dictators. It was exactly the same under Hitler, the same under Franco in Spain, and wherever you have a dictatorship, you have this kind of art, which is just serves one purpose only, namely to show how great the political ideas of the countries are.
Are the Russian films different now, though?
Yes, it depends on who sits on the Central Committee. You know, right now they again kicked out Yevtushenko from this what is it called? Writers. It's kind of a union or something like this. You have to belong to this, otherwise you cannot publish. They just won't print this stuff. Now, he has been in the West so frequently, so they always watch him. You know. They don't like that he is appreciated so much in the West. But then they said, okay, fine, it's a good advertisement of Russia if he is in the West, if all people like him in the West. But still, he didn't say enough how great Russia was, you know, what a marvelous country it is. So, but you have the same thing in sculptures, you know. Look at what Terry does here, or did here. Probably some of you met him, Terry Catterman, who did this welding sculpture. You have it on the altar over there. You know. And look at communist or Spanish sculptures or Hitler sculptures. Have you ever seen pictures of it, what they look like? They're always healthy youngsters, you know. The blossoming made him and the very strong and muscular young man. You know, usually the girls reaping, and the boys, I don't know, working in steel mills or something like that, you know, with shiny muscles, you know, and all this, and the nice ribbons saying, well, this is the great country, on to the future. It never works in communist countries or in countries with dictators, you know. It's always the future, of course, and that's why they have to show young people, you know, who will grow eventually, and then will make the country great. And this is just awful stuff, and it's very, very realistic. There's absolutely no artistic aim in it. It's just well done, you know. Just as a method to see what can be done to underline this idea, what can be done to make it great. But it's no art.
Well,
I mean, this is not to say that there are no good films in Russia. There are excellent films and there are excellent plays also. But it just depends who is sitting on the committee. Have you seen Russian films? Are they, I don't know whether they're being shown.
They had the Ballad of a Young Soldier. And that's pretty good, but it's a little, you know, schmaltzy.
Right.
And then War and Peace. That's our...
Oh, did you see that?
War and Peace, yes. I liked it, but boy, that's a long...
You go two nights.
In 7 hours long.
7 hours long.
They have an excellent war story. I don't know. I saw it in Germany, so I don't know the English title. Something about geese or grouse, which is called the wild geese or something like this. It's a marvelous thing.
I think I've only seen those two.
Mm-hmm. They also do excellent productions of Shakespeare. There's a Russian Othello film, which is just outstanding.
You're not thinking of Cranes Are Flying. I mean, that was a Russian film of about
is that
10
the title?
Years ago.
Uh-huh.
Cranes Are Flying.
I couldn't really tell.
That.
Uh-huh.
That was very well done, but there was plenty of Mother Russian. But I saw a film, Alexander Nevsky, that they did in the 30s under Stalin, and it was incredibly crude. If you compare that as a product of film, of cinema in the 30s with what was coming out of Hollywood, I mean, well, it was, of course, it was, well, I shouldn't say crude, but, well, in technique, but it... It just had one message, that was all. It's just the motherland, the motherland. But it's just, really, the impact was tremendous.
Yeah. Well, they have a tradition in film, which is outstanding. You know, just at the time of silent films, the Russians were outstanding. And since we are talking about films now, the old silent films are being rediscovered. I mean, not the Charlie Chaplin things only, but the old Eisenstein things, or how do you pronounce it, I don't know. Eisenstein, is the old. Okay, it's the same pronunciation, I just wasn't sure.
There.
Yes, okay, I don't know.
I saw one film, a Russian film, that had an art in the house that was fascinating to me because it was very Dostoevsky, and it had a lot of religious motifs in it that were came across very strong, and I was very interested.
Well, what?
And I can't remember the name of it, but it was
a big help.
But it was a very odd little theater that got very offbeat things that I don't think are shown many
times. You don't think you can get it for hold it.
Well, I don't, but it was set, what's that, you know, the earliest Russian culture, you know, Kiev, right? It was set back in that period, and they had a little kind of Marxist theme of the revolt of the son of the merchant class who identifies with the poor and so forth. But instead of having these poor sort of ending up as sort of the proletariat or something, it was much more like the old Dostoevskian hermit, you know, who comes and, you know, kind of a madman at the end. This is what this son of the merchant class ends up as, a kind of a prophet madman proclaiming against the rich or something.
Yeah, and as I said, also the fantastic Shakespeare films they have. When you have a chance to see this Othello made in Russia, it's just outstanding. It's really great. It's much better than any American or English film on Othello. There's only one little mistake in it. You know, this is just funny. They didn't pay attention. It was filmed on the, how do you call this insula in the Black Sea? Crimean. Okay, right there, and when Othello sort of doesn't know what to do, when his feelings are all mixed up, and they made this in this film, a rather good scene, I think, he goes out to the sea, to the shore, and there are fishermen's nets there, you know, and he walks and doesn't pay attention, and he gets entangled in these nets. It's a marvelous way of showing this in a film, you know, but at that time, a nice jet comes flying over there, you see that streak, you know, and that doesn't quite fit in, you know.
I saw a jet.
Otherwise, it's just superb, you know, what they do. So they are good films, but it depends on, as I said, who sits on the committees, you know. And you always have, under Stalin, almost nothing but trash. And then they got a little more lenient toward art and let them go on their own. And then back again. But also, an excellent example is music in Russia. And probably the Russian modern composers are the most outstanding ones. And if you look at also at the performing artists in Russia right now, the greatest pianists, cellists, violinists, where did they come from? Not from Europe, but from Russia.
Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that they sort them out in their educational system and really push them?
Yeah, they support them to a much, much greater degree than... Yeah. than. But it's also, I don't know...
Discipline.
Right, and they are put together in these, I don't know, it's a kind of Holden retreat, something
yeah,
like this,
like
very close to Moscow. They had to do this in the Second World War when the Hitler army marched in, so they protected them by, it's a place which must look similar to Holden.
Yeah.
Nothing but artists.
Yeah.
And they all live together and they help each other and it's fantastic. And this is where the great composers and musicians come from. But it's also a different, I would say, different kind of feeling of interpreting. You know? I don't know whether you've heard Vostropovich, the Russian cellist. When he plays a cello concerto, it's much more slowly. He takes his time. No, he can really sit and enjoy his own music. It's not this terrific speed, you know, this jet age. Go on, the Allegro, fast, go. You know, not so much technical brilliance only. They take their time. They sing and play with what they are playing. It's a different kind of feeling behind it. And this is, I think, why they have such a tremendous reputation here, and rightly so. So back to this, I would say. So they do have great art, but it depends whether it's stifled by the politicians or not. It's definitely there. And we appreciate this. I mean, back in music, you can see that. When you want to buy a Beethoven violin concerto, who's the performer? Usually a Russian. Or piano, the same thing. Russians. You know, and they are published by Columbia and Victrola and American companies. So here, too, you have the same idea. It is the good performance, the good poem, the good play that counts, not the communist play or the Czechoslovakian novel or the French poem. And this is something great, and I think something correct. Now, we may also add as another point, this came up yesterday when you mentioned the Cage, I think, didn't you? That there have never been greater experiments with language and means of expression. The technique of montage or ambiguity or destruction of rhyme and destruction of the stanza form, destruction of syntax. You almost have a hybrid growth of words on the one hand, and then you have an utmost abstraction on the other hand. The poets nowadays just try to push the possibilities to its very limits, just to say, how much can we really do with language? And this has never been greater than right now, in all countries. I mean, Yevtushenko does exactly the same thing than Cage would do in the United States. You know, in England,
Yevtushenko.
Pardon?
I think it was Jerry Evans
that
talked about it.
Oh, I don't remember. Just somebody mentioned it. I mean,
we all kind of took it up.
Pardon?
I think we all kind of sort of took it up.
Right. So the authors are much more aware than ever before of the technique, of the craft of writing literature, not only poetry. See, they're very, very conscious and very much aware of what they can do. Maybe this can be explained a little more when we talk the last point, which I think is rather, was a great discovery, namely the discovery of what is generally called mannerism nowadays. Have you ever heard of this term, mannerism? This is a completely new way of, let's say, writing the history of literature and of all art. This term had been known for a long time. Mannerism is just writing art, writing poetry, or creating any kind of art in a certain manner. Now, this was a period right after the Italian Renaissance movement in the 15th century, 14th and 15th century. All of a sudden, there were some artists who did not conform with the strict Renaissance ideals. In other words, of harmonizing all the elements of art. Everything had to be in a certain harmony. You had a rhythm, a meter, image, and as we said, the intellectual meaning of the words, and everything had to be centered into one certain point. Everything had to be in harmony. Think of a fabulous statue of Michelangelo, for instance, of his David or something. Everything, from the very material to the size, to the kind of marble, to the technique, how he chiseled it out, is in harmony. Everything fits together, and this is usually why we call it great, isn't it? That we have this harmony of everything. Everything fits together nicely. And this sort of creates the atmosphere, this creates what we would call a great work of art. Now, from the very beginning, we could say, from the 15th century on, there has been another school of artists who said, why? Why should we harmonize? So there were some painters who started painting their themselves, self-portraits, let's say, in a convex mirror, that their faces were completely distorted. Or you have the face sitting in the left-hand corner up there, and nothing else in the painting. This obviously was not harmony. You had a lot of empty space and the little face sticking out there in the corner. Or this went on to the fact that, let's say, the means of expressing something were so rich, there were so many of them, but there was absolutely no message, no theme in it. In other words, you said the same thing over and over and over again. You used another metaphor and another one, more and more and more. So again, you did not have a harmony of what you want to say and the means by which you try to achieve it. An intentional distortion. This primarily went on, and this is where many people saw this, in this mannerist movement right in the 15th century, especially in painting, especially with religious art, so that you mixed the most holy with the most profane, so to speak. I don't know whether you have seen paintings of usually women saints, or especially also Saint Mary. She's portrayed almost like a whore. In other words, you do not have this saintly face, but you have a tremendous emphasis on the breasts, or she is just the most beautiful woman you can think of. And when you were, pardon?
I missed that. Where was
this? In Italy.
In Italy.
I'm just trying to explain this mannerist movement.
Yeah.
There are some, most of the examples for this, unfortunately, are still in the caves of the Vatican. Because whenever there were saints or something like this, you know, this was painted, they bought it, and they are still there. There's a huge, huge museum up to this very day in the Vatican, you know, and they're only when you are, let's say, acquainted with somebody there, you may go in to study and write a book. But still, there's a tremendous amount of art, of this kind of art, which has never been shown, which we have never seen before. And usually it is this. You see that you have the most holy things, such as Mary. It's very easy, for instance, if you draw the two diagonal lines, in the center, you have the sexual organs all of a sudden, or you have breasts or something like this. And this is here, this is the Holy Saint Mary. In other words, a complete distortion of what we usually think of when we think of Mary, or of something like this.
Well, the allegorical great pictures of the Renaissance too, where you get the pagan allegory and the Christian symbol together. You know,
right.
Very
right.
Sensual.
When you get it together, it would still be, as is as it was called frequently, classical art or Renaissance art.
Yeah.
But when it was distorted intentionally, you know, like this, that you have the holy and the profane, or the holy and the dirt, you might say, it's intentionally filthy, it's pornographic. You know, it couldn't be more filthy in the 20th century. You see, when you have this together, it certainly, this is not a harmony, it's an intentional distortion. And this was called mannerism because people just said this is done in the manner of so-and-so. Usually the beginnings was Puntamo and others, and then more of this of these followed. Now, many scholars studied this in the 15th, 16th century, this intentional distortion of the classical harmony of Renaissance art, and discovered that in the history of art, including history of literature, you constantly had such an ebb and tide. You always had a classical movement, a harmonizing movement, and then a reaction against it, which distorted, destroyed this harmony. See, a constant up and down and up and down up to this very century. And I think this is a great way of writing the history of literature, the history of art, by just looking at these two contrasting forces that are constantly present. So there's, we have this original one. Sometimes they even go back to Egypt and say there was the same thing in Egyptian art. You know, first a classical movement, then a distortion of it. And then the greatest movement of this kind in the Italian Renaissance, 14th, 15th century, then late 15th, 16th century, the distortion. In Europe, in Northern Europe, I should say, what we call Baroque art would also be such a mannerist movement. You see, it would be exactly the same thing. Are you familiar with this term Baroque and what it means? Maybe the term helps. Baroque actually, if I'm not mistaken, is derived from pearl fishing originally. It means crooked, not smooth. Barocco in Italian. You know, when they found a pearl that they couldn't sell, it was just crooked, not a good shape. You know, they called this pearl Barocco. And also the critics in the beginning said, well, this is no good art. It's crooked. It's too much sometimes. You know, and then this term was called, this term was used for describing a certain kind of art, namely the so-called Baroque art. It's exactly the same thing.
You have churches where they have all the pearl cubes and the...
Yeah, usually you have an abundance of gold and saints and nice fat little angels, you know, with pink behinds, you know, and arrows, you know, tricks that a painting becomes a sculpture. Have you ever seen these funny things? There are some examples in Germany with a lord, you know, a painting of the Lord with a nice white beard, of course, which is ridiculous. All studies of God actually are always a little funny. You can't portray this.
And then it's literally broken arches too, where you have an arch that goes up like this, and then you break it with
right.
You see that constant
right.
Breaking of any yeah. Kind of smooth.
And you have this painting, a fresco, on the wall, and all of a sudden it sticks out in alabaster. You know, you have a foot sticking out of the painting. This is small. This is the famous toe of the Lord. You know, sticks out. The pigeons sit on it. You know, and drop something on it too.
So all art though supposed to be for not good.
It depends on your point of view. This is very characteristic. Let's say from a classical point of view, we would say not good. Mm-hmm. You see, it is not classical, it is detoured. It's just too much gold.
Yeah.
You see, except it's too many outer means, too much technique. You know, and what is inside is lost in an abundance of metaphors. You know, when you've ever looked at a Baroque poem, you know, they have at least 20, 30 metaphors of describing a beautiful girl.
Yeah,
or the same thing in the churches. You know, you have angels and angels and angels and angels. You can hardly see the altar. The structure of the church is completely destroyed by this abundance of decorations in it.
Yeah. I just wondered if there is any really essentially good art within this. I read recently that there's a tremendous revival of interest at least, probably all over the Western world, in Baroque music.
Yeah, this is a difficult thing, because the question is, do you call Johann Sebastian Bach, or Bach, as pronounced here, is he Baroque or Renaissance?
Are some of the great painters, I don't know, whether, say, canvases might go for $200,000, are they no good, or is it just...
Well, the money doesn't say much, usually. I mean, that's the New York critics, you know, you have terrific prizes for trash, you know this, you know, and little prizes for something good.
Historical, they value things historically, not necessarily always on their
right.
Potential.
Right, yeah. Right, definitely. But in general, I would say it depends on your point of view. When you say to me, art or any work of art has to be harmonized. You know, when I want to go into a church has to look like, let's say, a cathedral in Ravenna. The old, very old classical ones. Clear structure, all the lines, let's say, leading toward the altar or something like this. I know where I am. Whereas in the Baroque church, you don't know where to sit down.
Would you say that the powdered wig and the frill and all are also...
you could add...
the same
this.
Sort of...
yeah, but
frills in music and mordants and...
Yeah, in music, of course, there's that problem. People are used to calling Bach or Telemann or whoever there was at that time Baroque, because they wrote this music at the time when other Baroque art was created. But from the, let's say, the clear structure of a fugue or something like this is actually not Baroque. It's completely harmonized, concentrated, smooth from this point of view. It's actually more Renaissance classical than Baroque. But people are trying to rethink this right now. This is only after this idea of mannerism has come up that people all of a sudden say, well, Bach Baroque, that doesn't fit in. We should call him Renaissance, but we are so much used to listening to Baroque music, then we think of fugues, you know, we think of suites and so on, of these old forms.
Yes, yes. But there are some examples of Bach, for example, a B minor prelude. Mm-hmm. If you look at the manuscript, don't listen to the music, don't play the music, just look at the manuscript.
Yes.
It just looks Baroque. It just leaps off the page, and there's just too much, you know, there.
Yeah, I haven't seen many autographs, but I scratched a little bit on the violin, so I have the violin solo sonatas in autograph. It's just a reproduction of the autograph, of course. And this looks as clean and neat as it can be. This is very, very, but with other things, yes, and as he got older, since you're mentioning the B minor mass, and this is written later than the solo sonata.
Organ work, B minor.
Oh, sorry.
Well, did you say that mannerism would be a term, a rather general term, applicable to any?
I would say so. This is what many critics are trying right now. This is a very modern trend. As we said, well, first you have this old one, you know, in the 15th century. Then in the 17th century, primarily, this what we call Baroque is also the second mannerist period in our Western culture. Then as you go on, move in, to the Enlightenment period. You have the Enlightenment period, again, back to the classical idea. The reaction followed very, very fast what we call romantic. So the romantic movement would also be a third mannerist movement.
You mean like the Impressionists?
No. Yeah, it's a little strange because in England also you have a romantic movement which is only half romantic, so to speak. They didn't have a classical movement before. This was both together, so it's hard. But in Germany you have this. You know, you have Goethe, Schiller, these great authors, and then afterwards you have all these symptoms, you know, the destruction of forms, the destruction of thinking also. You know, this you have all the symptoms of mannerism in the so-called romantic movement. You cannot create a work of art, the romantics did. It's ridiculous.
But why do they want to call it mannerism instead of sticking to this, the old, you know, rather simple form of classical romantic, combination of those two, because actually you really can't categorize these things, I don't think, as neatly, you know, into every little form. And I wondered why did they pick up this new form now, it's called mannerism?
Because it doesn't mean a thing.
Exactly.
It just means in the manner of so-and-so, you know, and nobody knows this. and think of the term romantic. Now, since when I think of romantic, being a German, you know, I have a completely different definition of romantic than probably you have. You think of lots of feeling, moon, and things like that, isn't it? Love.
No, not in literature.
But still, this term romantic is so vague. I would say. That many critics think that actually the term mannerism would be even vaguer so that you can use it.
What do you think of in
pardon?
German background? What do you think of? Say you think of romantic as...
Of their philosophy, of their theory, of the romantic poets, primarily. In other words, the destruction of forms in many respects, this constant yearning and longing never to get there. The way is the thing that counts, not the goal that you will never reach. You cannot create any form of art, any work, because whatever you do is a false form. No, because once you think you have something that you could end, it's wrong, because the search goes on. That's a romantic idea.
Well, that sounds like
therefore the
too.
Pardon?
In English lit, that sounds like the theory.
Oh yes. So they didn't create anything. The highest form they had actually was what they called the fragment. And you have parallels everywhere. But again, this would only support this idea, you know, that you have this constant ebb and tide and ebb.
Where are
you
now?
Harmonizing in the early 19th century.
No, but you're getting that same thing in theology now, because as a reaction against the great systems, you know, Bartley, Brunner, and
exactly.
All wrote, you know, their systematics.
Yep. It's not only in art. It's,
yeah, now everybody is saying you can't write a systematics, all you can write is fragments.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this brings us to the last step, namely our time. From this point of view, our 20th century, actually starting with 1880, 1890, we are right now living again in a mannerist period, not only in art, but as you said, also in thinking. We do not want systems, for one thing, in theology. You know? We think we cannot centralize everything into one point. See, we don't have a theological system that would be binding for everybody. We don't have an ethical system. Think of the church, the children, situation, ethics, and others. Now, wherever you look, you don't have this. We have the intentional destruction of form. We have intentional gimmicks. Was mentioned last time in literature. You know, you have red print and green print and boldface print and small print and small letters and so on. We have distortion in paintings. You know, they have ridiculous things that nudes are painted, you know, and then rolled over an empty canvas, and that's called great art. You actually have characteristics that are exactly the same as those of the 16th century. So what, from this point of view, it's not such a great revolt we are experiencing right now, but it's recurrence, actually, of something that has been taking place a long time before. So the next step, maybe, in the 21st century, might be, again, a classical way of thinking, classical theory of art, and so on.
Right now, I think the poets are going through this hunting thing again, even though they're, you know, I mean, they aren't one of the beatnik poets, and then it shifts from New York to San Francisco, and now you're working on the harmony again, even though the poems don't sound, you know, I mean, this green ink business is out the window. And I think the poets are looking for this harmony. They're not looking for a classicism, I mean, like, you know, cut and dry, you know, stuff. But they're looking for almost a religious harmony.
Yeah.
It's a very religious age now, right now, with a lot of the poets.
Yeah.
They do this religious feeling is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And they are looking for harmony. They aren't destroying anymore.
Yeah, I would emphasize.
10 years from now, I think it's going to look a lot different.
Yeah, I would emphasize the term they are looking for. You know, you have a search which is almost exactly the same as that of the Romantic German English.
They're starting to. They're finding it though. Mm-hmm. Too, the Eastern religion thing sounds romantic, but it's to kind of put the circle around it. You know,
mm-hmm.
It is getting there.
Yeah.
They're arriving. They're not just searching blindly fragments, you know. People are coming up with ideas and you think they're
right.
You know, this is good.
I think so too. We do no longer like this revolt against the classical concentrated, centered or focused art or thinking of everything. This was nice in the beginning that you had music that only was, I don't know, terrible to the ear. I don't know. It was just funny noises, you know, all this electronic stuff. I don't know whether you think this is on the way up or on its way down right now.
Down.
I mean, you have a distortion too. It's fantastically well constructed, usually. Only the distortion takes place when you look at the fact that it doesn't sound well. You know, it sounds awful.
Well, the man is
computer film. You know.
Right, right. The same thing.
The man in popular music now, or the trendsetter is now Dylan. You know, always has been. I think he's got his Nashville Skyline, his latest album. He's right back. He's gone all the way back. He's the one that started the folk rock and really the acid rock. Now he's coming out with his. It's really not country western. There's a lot of people living it that way. It's more like, you know, way back to early England, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to change as far as popular.
Yeah, it is a rather hopeful outlook, I might say. You know, that when you look at hundreds and hundreds of years of history, and you have this constant, follow this wave theory, this up and down and up and down, and we are down or up, depending on your point of view. You know, it has to change now. You know, we will go in another direction. I don't know whether you can apply this to theology or any other fields, philosophy,
political history.
We can discuss this if you would like to. Whether you think there is a trend of harmonizing again. or whether we are still in the process of destroying, of individualizing. I don't have an answer. This is something we can talk about, but I don't think we can solve it. But I, in general, just to end this, I would say it's a very appealing theory. You know, starting from art, it goes up and down and up and down. There's a book by a man from Luxembourg by the name of Hocke, H-O-C-K-E, on mannerism. That's not only art, but also lots of theology, of course, lots of philosophy in it. This manner of thinking, it's very, very interesting. And from that time on, actually, more and more scholars got interested in it. First, they knocked at the doors of the Vatican, you know, wanted to get in and see all these filthy things, you know. And also, they looked at filthy thinking, you know, and this idea. And all of a sudden, they said, this is not filthy. This is just different. That's a different point of view to distort.
If you call this mannerism the antithesis, then what you're saying is sort of a fable, isn't it? Thesis, antithesis.
Right. Only if you say that the synthesis again will create an antithesis to it, okay, and that the process goes on. But with Hegel, it moved toward a certain goal. And this is rather.
This is a cycle.
Right.
I mean, Socrates.
He just took the technique.
Yeah.
And this moves towards something, what he called liberalization of the spirit or something like this.
Here's a mannerist prayer book, or I think maybe it's a mannerist prayer book, because you see the relationships aren't fixed. You switch that and then you get a different. You can make any kind of relationship because the pictures and the captions and the prayers are all separate. See, and you can just make any relationship you want. So the whole book becomes an event in which the relationships are not fixed. So the book itself, it's kind of.
Somebody wrote a book that way. It's on a stick, like a lollipop, and the pages go out like this. And you just pick it up.
Yeah, this kind of thing is very, very big in Christians or whatever you want. I mean, this whole kind of thing has really blossomed out in religion and liturgy and all that, which is a fascinating kind of.
In modern sculpture, I think you have an excellent example for this. Usually, when you looked at a piece of sculpture, you know, here you were, and there was the piece of sculpture, and you looked at it. Nowadays, I don't know whether you have seen this 1968 attempts. You enter the sculpture. It is huge, and you crawl in, sometimes on all fours, you know. I've seen one that was really interesting, where you had, I don't know, they had some kind of magnetic device, and you had pillars, just like these here, that move constantly with a screeching noise all the time. And you had to fight these off constantly. They were coming toward, you know, like this. And you walked into that thing. Or they're completely dark rooms with these very intense fluorescent lights in it that you can't see a thing. Only your nylon shirt, for instance, will light up, you know, like a torch.
Yeah.
Otherwise, completely dark. You only see the outlines of the room. You know. Things like that, or what they do with mirrors.
This kind of thing's been used in liturgy too, for a while. There's this one Episcopal church in New York that had this, I think it was Lenten liturgy, and they led you through this whole kind of experience. It was really kind of a Kafkaesque kind of thing. At one point, you walked into this room, and there were the kind of judges sitting there. You had to write out your sins, and then they threw it into a
there was one.
Yeah, it was just wild, and it actually had some sort of perverse aspect. But you really felt like you'd been something, but you forgot through that liturgy.
So this liturgy or this piece of sculpture isn't anything unless you focus it, when you do this. So, and the term perverse is used from a classical point of view, but from the other point of view, you can't use it anymore.
I seem to get a feeling that maybe mannerisms or the mannerist movement in all the arts would be considered the kind of temporary state of flux and not without too much inherent worth until you get back on the track, but you don't, aren't, do you imply that or not?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, primarily, His Holiness in Rome stifled this. They had a censorship which is much more severe, actually, than ours nowadays. And so these works were just supposed to be, were called perverse, bad art, nonsensical, idiotic. Look at that fool, you know, belongs to a nut house, but this is really not art. And so right now, from this point of view, we start to reevaluate this. See that all of a sudden things are being dug out which formerly were thought to be trash. And that's why people just go to the Vatican and start digging. You know, there's lots of it.
So all of the works that have been produced that you might call mannerist aren't necessarily trash.
No, this depends entirely on your point of view. I mean, nowadays we would we rather like those works than let's say the David by Michelangelo.
Yeah.
We think that's nice, but it leaves you completely cold. It's so perfect, so harmonized that we just stand and say, well, isn't that a nice piece of cheese? And we all look at the late period of Michelangelo, for instance, these figures for a tomb which he never finished. You know? This is mannerist. He changed in his lifetime, according to this theory, if you follow it. No. And this all of a sudden is appealing. There's life in it. But this David, you know, it's beautiful. So what?
Isn't the Last Judgment on the wall in the Sistine Chapel? That's the beginning sort of mannerist period.
Right.
And just created consternation.
Right.
Because of all the naked figures of their gods and things. And the whole had garments painted.
Didn't they do that later?
No, already that time.
Oh, I thought that was kind of the next century they went in there.
No. Just Michelangelo himself changed in his lifetime. He changed his own style, so to speak.
Isn't that, you know, the famous picture of God creating Adam and God's got a nightshirt on. Isn't the nightshirt added on there?
Lots of Rembrandt also is mannerist.
Yeah.
These dissections, again, this is a marvelous thing. So, you know, you've probably seen this Dr. So-and-so, anatomy of Dr. So-and-so, things like that. Where you have the horror of death presented in medical terms, where they all sit there, presented as something nice, a marvelous distortion. So you find this everywhere, only we pay much more attention to it now.
Did the Vatican buy up all these things in order to censor or hide them away?
To hide them, most of it was burned. We don't know. I've never been there, you know, I can't get in, but this is just what I gather from this book, you know. This man obviously knew one of the, what do you call it, Curia cardinals? This select few.
Yeah, yeah.
The Curia?
Well, the Curia is different from cardinals. The cardinals are an international body, whereas the Curia is sort of the mafia.
Right. He knew one of them, and so he got in and could study this. And he was amazed with what was there. They just thought it shouldn't be published. You know, it's not bad. It's bad for the average person, and only the scholar should do that. Okay, that was it. But nowadays, we get more and more and more of it. Just study one of these books, but sit down, you're in for a shock. I mean, books on mannerism, when you see their illustrations in there, it's amazing what they did. In our time, you know, when we think of nudes on the stage or all films, that's just nothing. That's just so tame, you know. Nobody would have looked at it in the 16th century. You know?
So we don't have to worry that we're going to the dark.
No, from this point of view, not.
Before.
It's not only in art, but it's also in thinking. If you follow the theory, we can only go the other direction now.
Yeah. Well, even compared to the late 19th century, where you had such a tremendous fascination with perversity and drugs and so forth, it would be pretty hard to top that.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I think it's 12 o'clock. Wasn't this prayer meeting, isn't that here?
Yeah.
Because the weather is so bad.
Yeah.